About half the country has a state requirement in place that students complete some kind of personal finance coursework in order to graduate. A Republican-backed bill would have added Wisconsin to that list. It failed to pass last month. So what are students in the state learning about managing money? How effective are current state standards? And can parents talk to their kids about what can they talk to their kids about when it comes to making good financial decisions? We're tackling those questions as we come to the end of National Financial Literacy Month, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Parents, do you talk to your kids about money? Kids, have you had conversations about money with your parents and what should happen in schools when it comes to financial literacy? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melody Harvey is an assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology's Department of Consumer Science. She studies the effects of public policies on financial capability, decisions, and well-being, especially in economically vulnerable populations. She also works with the UW Institute for Research on Poverty. Melody, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you all so much for having me as well.
We don't have this, you got to have a high school credit in financial literacy now in Wisconsin. We do have some curriculum, though, that gets mixed in throughout the school career. What kind of things do we have under this law passed in 2017?
And so generally, every state with content standards covers some aspect of credit and debt management, general money management, saving and investing, and understanding consumer rights and responsibilities. And some states, including Wisconsin, also cover career and post-secondary education planning, retirement planning, homeownership, the role of financial mindset, and understanding the effects of limited personal finance on decision-making, and even understanding the use of high-cost borrowing, such as payday loans, auto title loans, and rent-to-own financing. So it covers the wide gamut of financial decisions that we may encounter in our day-to-day.
I know a big part of your research, Melody, is does this stuff work? Looking at other research, looking at your own research, what do we know about the impact that different kinds of financial literacy education in schools has on what people do when they grow up and become young adults?
And so overall in research, we are seeing that young adults who were exposed to required personal finance courses to graduate fare better in credit outcomes and debt decisions. And so in particular, they have higher credit scores on average and are less likely to be credit delinquent. We see them less likely to resort to high-cost borrowing, particularly payday loans. And among young adults who decide to go on to college or some form of post-secondary education training, we see that they are more likely to fill out a FAFSA, which translates to more grants and scholarships on average, as well as trading off the generally cheaper, cheaper federal student loans in lieu of the more expensive private student loans.
We're talking about schools so far. You pointed us toward a couple surveys of parents and how much they talk to their kids about financial issues. What do we know about the role that parents can play in instilling financial literacy in their kids?
And so according to a recent survey by CNBC and Acorns, they find that only 15% of parents said they spoke with their children more than once a week about household finances. Another 13% said they do so once a week, and 16% said they did so once a month. And some 24% of parents said they talked to their children even less often in apps, and around 30% report that they never speak with their children about personal finances. And much of this is driven by a degree of discomfort parents report having in discussing money matters with their children, especially amidst concerns that they themselves don't necessarily feel like they are experts in money management. But other research such as those by Dr. Margaret Achobarger at Chicago Booth, find that children as young as 5 have developed feelings about spending and saving money. And so some easy strategies, especially with younger children, include reading books about money with them, as well as integrating it into math lessons they are learning. And in cases of slightly older children and teenagers, this can even be as simple as going to the bank with your teenager and helping them set up a bank account and explaining how banking works.
Yeah, that's interesting. The fear that a parent might not have enough expertise. I mean, is there just value in something as simple as we are saving up to go on a vacation, replace the water heater, whatever. Here's how we're setting money aside every month. Just that kind of nuts and bolts stuff. Is there value in bringing kids on board with that?
There certainly is value with discussing how you're using money and towards what expenses with children. And research has shown that that can help mold the financial behaviors that they will eventually mimic. And another strategy we have seen be effective includes either providing some sort of allowance or even allocating as small as $5 while in a grocery store and having it be snack money, for example, to help orient children to learn how to spend versus save versus compare prices.
We're talking about financial literacy and education with Melody Harvey, assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology's Department of Consumer Science. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, do you have little lessons like that that you've done with your kids? How allowance works, how a bank account works, how you save money, that kind of thing. Is there a lesson that you learned maybe in your own childhood or young adulthood that really helped you get a handle one way or another on money? And hey, how about schools? What kind of education do you want to see going on there? Do you want a formal high school class that you got to pass to graduate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about what Wisconsin students learn about managing their money and finances in schools and at home. Melody Harvey stays with us, assistant professor in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology's Department of Consumer Science. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you teach your kids, if any, about money? How did you learn about money growing up? What have you seen in schools? Do you include financial literacy, if you're a teacher, in what you teach your kids, your students? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Anna is with us in Janesville. Anna, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Anna?
So I started when my kids were like 5 and 7, when we would go to the grocery store, we kind of budgeted. I would give them amount, say $100, and one of the kids would have the calculator and the other one would have the list. And once we got close to that $100 mark, we would talk about what was left on the list and what maybe we could do without, like cookies, and what needed to be in the cart, like milk, to kind of keep that budget going. And now that they're older, one of them is really good with money and the other one still needs a little bit of help, but those seeds were planted as they grew up with kind of, you know, needs versus wants with budgeting our money a bit.
And I got to ask, were they willing to give up the cookies?
Actually, a lot of times they were, because there was a lot of compromise that could be made instead of, you know, this particular cookie that was, you know, X amount. Maybe they would be okay with getting this cookie that was a little cheaper.
Fantastic. Anna, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Melody, starting at 5 years old in that case could make a difference, it sounds like.
Right. That's absolutely right. And that's the age where research has determined they've already developed feelings about spending and saving money. So that's certainly a great time to begin discussing and orienting children to spending money and budgeting and comparing cost at the grocery store, as our caller Anna points out.
Anna, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go to Pete now in Montello. Pete, hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you want to share with us, Pete?
Well, you know, like I heard a little bit earlier here on the young lady that was on before, but starts off at an early age, and it's the parents' responsibilities to their kids. And it's just like your little daughter or son, they come up and they want $1 to play a video game. So you give them $1. Then they come back. Maybe you're at some type of social event, and they come back, they want another $1. And then you give them another $1. Then they come back, they want another $1. So you finally tell them, well, here's a $10 bill. Do with it what you want, but that's all you're getting. Or you can save it, and you can buy something else later. So that starts off at an early age. But then when they get older, it's amazing how many kids, like right out of high school, don't understand what it costs to live a year.
Mm-hmm.
Pete, thanks a lot for that call. Melody, let's pick up on that last point. At the high school level, when kids are, you know, likely going to leave the nest pretty soon, what are some of the key things that we want to make sure they know at that point?
Some of the key things include how to budget for these life expenses. And so, of course, not only understanding how much groceries cost, but also understanding how much rent costs, and if they own a car, how much maintaining a car costs, including gas, periodic maintenance, and insurance. And if they are deciding to pursue any form of post-secondary education training or going on to college, also understanding the cost associated with college, including what they'll need in order to pay out of pocket versus what they may need in terms of borrowing.
Pete, thanks.
And so that list grows, of course, substantially mm-hmm. as you're approaching high school graduation and preparing to leave the nest.
Pete, thanks a lot for the call. And Melody, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Melody Harvey, assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology's Department of Consumer Science. She joined us today to talk about personal finance education in Wisconsin, what students learn at school, what we could teach them at home, and you can keep sharing your experiences. Email centraltime@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kiev this past weekend. The Secretary of Defense shared on Monday that the U.S. wants the Russian military, quote, weakened.
We want to see Ukraine remain a sovereign country, a democratic country, able to protect its sovereign territory. We want to see Russia weakened to the degree that it can't do the kinds of things that it has done in invading Ukraine. So it has already lost a lot of military capability and a lot of its troops, quite frankly.
John Reuter is an associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
That particular quote from the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin got a lot of attention. It speaks, some people said, to a goal that we hadn't really known about. Apart from getting Russia out of Ukraine, the idea of having the Russian military capability weakened to the point that it can't do something like this again. Is this a significant statement?
I think so. And I think it signifies a subtle shift in strategy for the U.S. and Western allies from one of deterrence, especially early on in the invasion, with the goal of sanctions and arms deliveries to Ukraine was to prevent Russia from escalating the conflict still further. But of course, that's already happened. And now that the Ukrainian military has demonstrated considerable battlefield effectiveness, I think what the West has decided is that they would like to expand its aims to potentially try to contain Russia from invading any of its other neighbors in the future, and more specifically from reinvading Ukraine in the future.
Does that play into Russia's internal propaganda, being able to say, hey, look, here's an American leader saying they want to weaken us, given the sort of looking glass that the people of Russia see this all through? I don't know. Does that help build support for Putin in some ways?
I mean, the answer is yes and no. I mean, so the yes part of the answer is yes, of course, because this plays right into the type of rhetoric they use that is really quite frightening, right? If you watch Russian state television, the type of rhetoric they, on some of the more propagandistic shows that they use, is this kind of rhetoric that Russia faces this existential crisis, this existential threat from the West, that it is under attack by NATO and that it's having to defend itself from being wiped off the map. That's literally the type of rhetoric they sometimes use. And obviously, you know, if you take that rhetoric to its logical conclusion, it has really quite frightening consequences. However, the no part of the answer is that they use this rhetoric already, even without, you know, even before, in this case, Secretary Austin making this statement. So it's not clear the extent to which it matters what Western leaders actually say. It's really what Russian propagandists portray them as saying.
Speaking of changes in the nature of the war and Western support from Ukraine, it seems like there's more and heavier military equipment flowing from not just the U.S., but other NATO allies. Germany now looking like it's going to start sharing heavier equipment than they, and I think anybody, thought they would even consider doing at some point. What do you see driving that that ramp up in that kind of commitment?
Yeah, that's right. I think a number of things. Well, first, we should say that in general, well, at the very beginning of the conflict, there was a hesitancy to provide Ukraine with weaponry because they didn't want this to provoke retaliation from Russia or have that lead to a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO, given all the grave consequences that would have. I think that fear of that has somewhat diminished. That's the first thing to note. The second thing that has all along that Western leaders have been hesitant about doing is providing offensive weaponry to Ukraine or weaponry that could be used with an offensive capacity, because then Ukraine might do something like, I don't know, make an incursion across Russia's border or, you know, take the fight to Russia more, and then that could lead to further escalation. So the emphasis has been on defensive weaponry. But now, as you note, we're starting to see that line get blurred a bit in some countries, especially European countries have started to talk about providing more heavy weaponry. And I think another part of the reason for that is that the battlefield situation has changed. And I think there's now a realization that Ukraine might be able to not just hold off Russia, but maybe even retake some of the territory that it's lost. And it seems like some in Europe think that effort should be supported.
How do you see Russia's aims changing here? Initially, I think, based on things that Russian news sources have said, the intention, the thought was that they would quickly take over all of Ukraine and then absorb it or, put in a puppet replacement for the current government there. What now, though, are they looking for?
I mean, the first thing to note is their aims are changing quite rapidly. They're very different now than they were on the first day of the war. I think it's pretty clear, at least to me, on the first day of the war, their aim was to topple the Ukrainian government and install a puppet regime. I actually don't think their initial aim was to take all of Ukrainian territory and make it part of Russia. But that became just practically impossible, that is, to toppling the Ukrainian government using the methods that Russia was using. And so they've changed their aim midstream, and now their aim, it seems pretty clear, is to capture as much territory in the east, in particular to capture the rest of Luhansk and Donetsk Oblast, and then to broker some sort of deal that would create some stalemated conflict in eastern and southern Ukraine that would destabilize the Ukrainian state.
Another piece of news, the U.S. planning on reopening diplomatic offices in Kiev. President Biden saying Monday he wants to nominate Bridget Brink, current U.S. ambassador to Slovakia, to be the ambassador in Ukraine. Now, what do you make of those efforts to kind of rebuild the formal structure of American diplomacy with Ukraine?
I think they were. I don't think that they're particularly surprising. It was to be expected at some point once it became clear that Russia was no longer going to be trying to take Kiev. That American diplomats and Western diplomats would return to Kiev. So I don't see it as particularly surprising, actually.
John Reuter is with us, associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the latest news in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the NATO and the U.S. response as well. John, the humanitarian situation, of course, a horrific, huge flow of refugees out of Ukraine into Western Europe and beyond, many more people displaced within Ukraine. Is there any sign, at least in the places that Russian troops have abandoned, of some sort of normalcy resuming?
In Kiev, certainly. Of course, Kiev proper was never occupied by the Russians, but people are streaming back into Kiev, and life does appear to be resuming some sense of normalcy there. Elsewhere as well. I mean, I think thus far, I'm not sure if this should be interpreted as a silver lining, but relevant to other conflicts like this, the speed with which refugees have returned has been rapid. So there's been, I think the latest figures show there's been more people going back in, many more people going back into Ukraine from Poland and Eastern Europe than leaving over the past couple weeks. So that's a good sign. But of course, we have to remember that there are huge swaths of the country that are still under Russian occupation. And then there are also very, very large cities in Ukraine that are not far from the front lines, and that the refugee situation is still precarious there.
Now, what should be happening in Ukraine this time of year is what would be happening in Wisconsin this time of year. People getting ready to plant crops. Ukraine feeds itself and a lot of the world. How, even if the war ended, you know, in 10 minutes from now, how much do you worry about Ukrainian agriculture and the economy being disrupted?
Current estimates, I may be mistaken on this, but current estimates are that Ukrainian GDP will drop 40% this year. So this is larger than the GDP drop that Ukraine experienced after the fall of the Soviet Union. So it's an absolute cataclysm for Ukraine. The parts of Ukraine that had already been contested under Russian occupation even before the war constituted a huge portion of Ukraine's economy, about 15%. And then the parts that are now under Russian occupation constitute approximately another 8%. So just, you know, in territory loss, much of Ukraine's economy has been taken away. And this has disruptive knock-on effects on the Ukrainian economy because, you know, production networks are linked and, you know, factories can't get the supplies they need from other factories within the country. And to your question about agriculture, this affects the agricultural sector as well. A lot of the emphasis in the media has been on, you know, direct impacts to agriculture, like, you know, war going on in agricultural land. But the more serious threat to Ukrainian agriculture is that modern agriculture is highly mechanized and requires sophisticated production chains, and they've all been disrupted by the war. And so it's going to have a major effect on Ukrainian food exports.
John, we've got a whole conversation about this scheduled for tomorrow, but I wanted to take our last minute to ask you, what does it take to have a successful peace negotiation with this active, hot war going on in Ukraine right now?
I mean, the first thing to note, the most important thing to note is that I don't think there can be peace negotiations until the war reaches some sort of definite, very clear stalemate. Because right now, neither side has an incentive to negotiate much when they both think that they can make more gains on the battlefield. And so that's what's been hamstringing negotiations for the past several weeks, is the uncertain battlefield situation. So politically, it's just not worth speculating about what it's going to take until it becomes clear what each side controls.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks.
That's John Reuter, associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. John talked with us today about U.S. officials meeting in Ukraine this past weekend, the latest on the Russian invasion.